So we're in Vayikra Chav Bet Chav Chet 22:28.
One more page.
Page 680. No. 680, 681. Yeah. Okay. So the Torah says, "V'sharu se, o tovi et bino, lo tishchatu biyom echad." An ox or a sheep or a goat, you may not slaughter it and its offspring on the same day. Okay? The verse before also is interesting, in 26 and 27. Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain under its mother for 7 days, and from the eighth day on it is acceptable for a fire offering to Hashem. So you can never sacrifice an animal within the first 7 days of birth. Even on the altar, even in the Beit HaMikdash, and you're never allowed to slaughter a mother and child on the same day. It's called Otov Yepino. Okay? This refers to the mother. Okay? So, father you can, because in the animal world, fathers tend not to be that involved. So, the mother and the child, you can't slaughter on the same day. So, what seems to be the root of this mitzvah? What's it about?
This is
Oso,
though.
What?
Him, right?
Oso is Pino. Him. Yeah, so, no, you're right. So that's what Rashi says. Noah ben Akeva. Sh'asha lishchota aim ve'ben o'abat ve'na noah be'zacharim. U'mutu lishchota avi aben. So, you're right. It is written in the masculine. That's true. So Rashi says that the Gemara and the Midrash said that this really means the mother and the child. So you don't even know who the father is in the animal world. I mean, not the easiest thing to figure out always. So let's just start doing like a paternity test on bulls and stuff like that, you know.
They did one on my dog.
They did a paternity test? Really?
On dogs? On my dog, yeah.
Is that true?
Was that on Jerry Springer?
No. It's that the...
Well, you have to pay child support.
The breeder used artificial insemination for breeding his dogs.
Oh, really?
And it turned out one of his dogs short-circuited the process and did it the old-fashioned way.
Uh-huh.
And so...
It defined the dog?
He was the father of both litters instead of just one.
So, who your dog was?
No, his father was. They had two litters.
Right.
And his father was the father of both litters. Where he's only supposed to be the father of one.
Uh-huh.
And another dog is supposed to be the father of the other.
Okay.
So they do turn it.
So it could be in Jerry Springer. Okay.
More important.
So what seems to be the issue of this mitzvah? Why do we have such a concept? What's your initial reaction to it?
Well, it causes pain to the animal.
Okay. Right. So this seems. So there's pain to the animal or to the child, because if you slaughter the mother first, then then it's pain to the child. Now, in theory, you could do it in a way that the other one doesn't know about it, right? You could take the child away from the mother and slaughter the mother, and then that's fine, right? That's not against the Torah. And then a day later, shech the mother. It's just as painful for the mother to. In some ways, maybe it's less cruel to do them all in one shot instead of having one wait. So there seems to be, beyond just the pain to the animal, there seems to be some sort of, I don't know, justice, or it's too unfeeling, too cruel to do this, you know, for ourselves. Like this, you know, it's like Saving Private Ryan, right? Okay, so there's five sons, and four of them are killed in battle, and there's a fifth son, so we should risk other soldiers' lives to bring the fifth son back for the pain of the mother at home? It's like, well, you know, they're all soldiers. Why should we put our... That's a big theme of the movie. Why should we put our lives at risk to save this other one? How is he better than us?
Because he's the fifth child of a mother.
Right, so the answer is... Because there's something cruel about it.
And I concern there's a
wound.
I hope it's not a
wound.
I know wound. Sorry, maybe I was. I don't know. I thought I was. I'll get up next time, I think.
My mom, he didn't lock himself out. That's good.
Nobody did? I'm sorry, Rabbi.
It's okay. So there's something that feels wrong about it. It's hard to go beyond that. Something that feels wrong about it. So part of this is the way we treat animals, you know, it kind of defines us. Defines our, and helps sharpen our sense of, our sensitivity to the animal world. Let's go to another example.
Is this more a case where it's not necessarily cruel to the animal, but we feel it's cruel? Because the animal may not know the difference.
That's what I'm saying.
It could be. It does to us more so than what it does to them.
Right.
So
no,
the
it could
same
be.
Category as not cooking
a kid in its mother's milk.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
that's nothing to the slaughtered animal. It's what it does to us.
Yeah, it's interesting, but that's not usually seen as something that is cruel. But you're right, it's true. The way the Torah describes the prohibition of meat and milk is do not cook a kid in its mother's milk, which just portrays, right, this image of the same thing that should have been there to feed it and to help it grow.
It's cruelty.
Right. No, it's true. It's portrayed as a certain amount of cruelty to have milk, which represents life-giving, and meat, which represents death. So, no, for sure. No, you're right. It's a good point.
More so, but it's an ultimate insult. Not only you slaughtered that animal, but then you use its milk to make it taste better.
It's
right.
Almost like the ultimate diss. That's what I always explain to my staff, like with, you know, non-Jews, like with about kosher. I just tell them we separate life from death. And,
right.
You know, I'm like, think about it. Wouldn't it be the ultimate insult to be like, I'm going to kill you and eat you in your mother's milk, you know?
That would be pretty bad.
Yeah, it's like Rambo, like, you know, worse than that, you know?
That's a mean stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so you're right. It's a good point. It's a good point. The way it's portrayed, now, okay, again, most times people eat meat and milk, that's not what they're doing, right? If you're having cow milk, and you're having a cheeseburger, the odds are pretty slim that the milk that you're eating is in the meat you're eating or mother-child relationships. So you're right, it's put very dramatically in the Torah, but it's more what it represents as a whole of life and death coming together.
But if that is the real reason, then from a biblical point of view, you can take a deer and slaughter it, cook it in its own milk, and it's cooked. Completely permitted from a biblical point of view.
Why could you have a deer?
Because
it's not a kid.
It's not a domesticated animal.
No, but the Torah says that a chaya, a non-domesticated animal, the Torah prohibition of meat and milk applies to wild animals too.
Why not?
Poultry not, but yes, wild animals at the end, right? It does apply to wild animals too. It does apply to wild animals too. But,
I'm 99% sure. The kid in the cow's milk as opposed to
right, so a goat in cow's milk or yeah. Something. Right, so the Gemara gets into all of this. The Talmud talks about all these questions. You know, ultimately the Talmud's like, look, it's just dramatic. It's saying you can't have meat and milk together. That's what it means. But it's being dramatic because it's giving some sort of lesson. You know, not that the Torah's law is dependent on that lesson, but it is infusing it with a certain meaning that's pretty dramatic, that's pretty obvious. So good point, Leonard. I'll add that to the source sheet.
Thank you.
And I'll write Leonard
right.
On it.
Right.
Please see Leonard for further questions. So another example, number two. So Devarim 22, 6 and 7. So this is probably, I don't know, the most obvious, but one of the most obvious example. So if we go to page 1050.
1050.
So the Torah says, verse 6 and 7, Vavan Zion, Ki Karekan Sipo Lefenecha Baderech Bekol Eitz, Oala Aretz Efrochim, O Beitzim, Ve'aim Rovetzet Ala Efrochim, Oala Beitzim, Lotikacha Aim Ala Banim. If a bird's nest happens to be before you on the road, or on any tree or on the ground, young birds or eggs, and the mother is roosting on the young birds or the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely send away the mother, right in Hebrew, shalech tishalech etza'am, v'etabanim tikach lach, l'man yitav lach, v'erach t'yamin. You shall surely send away the mother and take the young for yourself, so that it will be good for you and will prolong your days. Okay? So here we have a mitzvah that's colloquially called kan sipur. It means the nest of the bird. But there's a mitzvah that if you want to take an egg from a nest, you have to shoo away the mother and then take the egg. And then the Torah even adds that this will prolong your days. So interesting, there's only two mitzvot. There's only one of the mitzvot in the entire Torah that says your days will be prolonged if you do that mitzvah. You know what that other mitzvah is? Kibavim, honoring your parents. Right? Those are the two that the Torah says. So why those two? So the best answer I heard is the Talmud refers to sending away the mother bird, as in, I think Rashi even quotes it here, as the ultimate example of an easy mitzvah. Right? There's not much you have to do. So Rashi says, so mitzvah is a mitzvah kalash ein ba chiseron kis. So Rashi says, why does it say specifically with this mitzvah that you get your days prolonged? Because if a mitzvah that's this easy to do, doesn't cost you any money, I don't have to do anything, it's not like Pesach, it's not like don't steal, it's something I'm doing positively, that's as easy, I'm just literally shooing my hand, and that's it, that's the whole mitzvah. So if this mitzvah I get credit for in the world to come. So imagine the mitzvahs that are hard, right? Imagine what that's going to be like. So that's the way Rashi puts it. So another way of putting it is that this mitzvah represents an easy mitzvah. The Talmud looks at this example of the easiest mitzvah, or at the very least, a mitzvah that seems like it's like not that big of a deal, right? So take that seriously.
It goes for like chickens too. It's a bird.
No, so chickens are a good question. What do they do in a hen house, right? They shoot them. They shoot them away all day. So of course they don't fly, but you're not happening upon those birds. Those are, you're raising them. It's a little different.
Yeah.
Plus they don't fly, so they can't. You can't really shoot them away so much.
Yeah.
Well, kind of. Yeah, a little bit. At least it's referring to birds that fly, so that's why it only applies to chickens. But anyway, So this example of the easiest mitzvah, and kibud av v'aim is considered the hardest mitzvah. Honoring your parents is considered the hardest mitzvah in the Torah. It's the one that it's hard because it's constant, right? There's no end to it. It happens in your entire life. You're even after parents passed away, you're obligated to honor them and how you speak about them and how you honor their memory. So, and during your lifetime, there's no mitzvah that can be more time-consuming, more overwhelming than honoring your parents. So, the hardest mitzvah and the easiest mitzvah, the Torah says this, so therefore, it applies to everything in between. Anyway, a little side note. But, so what's the purpose of this mitzvah? So here you have a big big discussion in the commentaries that different interpretations are given. So, One stream of thought here is that it's for the animal, right? So here the Ramban quotes the Rambam. Maimonides says, "Kasav harab mo nevuchim kitam shel chakan tamos veispinolos will be a mechay kedei lahazir shlo yishchot the ben be'enei ha'em ki yesh behemot daga gadol bezeh." he says, he compares these two mitzvahs that we've seen. The mitzvah of not shechting a mother and child on the same day, and this mitzvah of sending away the mother. Why do we have it? So the Rambam, Maimonides writes in the Guide to the Perplexed, it's because animals have feelings too. And we don't want the mother to see you taking the egg, and we don't want the child to see you slaughtering the mother or vice versa. You can do it in a way that the child or the mother won't see, but if we prohibit it, then we're guaranteed that it will never happen. And he adds, "V'ein hefresh ben dagat ha'adam l'dagat ha'behema al b'neihem," because when it comes to the animal world, they love their children too, right? Animals will sacrifice their lives for their children. They do so all the time, right? They'll protect them. Sorry?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's something that we have in common with the animal world. That doesn't, you know, there's a few animals maybe don't care so much. You know, especially those that lay eggs, they're not as concerned. But
or fish.
That's right. Fish, you know, I'm thinking of turtles, you know how they lay the eggs and they run away and they if the sea turtles, if the babies can make it to the water, great. If not, their problem. You know? Any animal that's laying hundreds or thousands of eggs, hoping a small percentage will survive, they don't care so much. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So
fish?
No, turtle.
Certainly, squid do that. A lot of, you know, but they still protect it. They try to protect it. You know, sometimes, but they'll lay like thousands of eggs. The turtles lay a bunch of eggs, and
yeah, but they bury those eggs.
Right, then you bury them. Right. That's true.
They do something,
and then they leave.
And then they leave, and they hatch, and
right, yeah. But they bury it, make sure that they hatch, and they do something.
They do something. Yeah. Right. I'm not saying they should be arrested or
fish
anything.
Fish doesn't do anything because fish is cold-blooded.
There you go. All right.
Fish is cold-blooded.
So you're right. So that's one situation where human beings and animals are the same. So it's just, he says, "Ki avas ha'em v'chanuta lebnei bitna einenu nimshech echrei ha'secha v'yadibur," because an attachment between mother and child is not something that is, it's not intellectual, it's emotional. So animals don't need to have any more thought than, you know, any more intelligence than we do to have that same feeling. So therefore, since this is a part of the animal world where animals will feel pain and suffering, so therefore, according to the Rambam, that's why we have these mitzvahs. That's Maimonides' perspective. The Ramban disagrees. So Nachman disagrees and says, you know, if they really care, you know, if they really care about them, we couldn't eat them. We couldn't kill them at all. Right? So obviously, how much does God really care about them? About their emotional pain and suffering? Not physical. This is not physical pain and suffering. This is emotional pain and suffering. So how much does God care about the emotional pain and suffering of an animal? Not really. So according to the Ramban, the issue is not, the reason for these mitzvot is not for the animals' pain and suffering, is that we don't be cruel. Right? No, we shouldn't be cruel. And, don't be cruel because I would never be cruel to you. So don't be cruel to them. So that's so there's a disagreement as to what it's about. But here we see two mitzvot that are based on the concept of animal cruelty. The only question is, do we care about animals' emotional cruelty to animals because of our, is it for us or is it for the animal? That's a discussion. Okay, the third case is Shemot 23:5. And this mitzvah is not only mentioned once in the Torah, but this is the first time that it's mentioned. Page. Page
434.
430. 434.
432
to the last word. 432? Oh. Yeah, English Shelton. So it's verse 5. So the Hebrew is ki tirecha mor sonacha rovetz tachat masao chadata me'azov lo azov tazovimo. If you see the donkey of someone you hate crouching under its burden, Would you refrain from helping him? You shall help repeatedly with him. And so it's a very funny language here. And the Talmud learns a lot of different laws from it. But the overarching thing here is that if an animal is suffering under great weight, more than it can carry, a great burden, so you should help take the burden, and you should help remove the things from the animal so it's no longer in pain. So here we have physical suffering to an animal. So we have a mitzvah that tells us that we have an obligation to alleviate animals from physical pain. Okay? Now this mitzvah, like I said, there's a lot of different details to it. Why is they the person that you hate? Why is they should repeatedly help him? So, okay, there's a lot of different issues here. If you'll do with someone you hate, of course, you know, you don't need a mitzvah to do for someone you love necessarily, but someone you hate, you have to do it too. You should overcome your desire. You know, even though you hate someone, doesn't mean the animal should suffer. Right? Very often hatred has a lot of collateral damage. Other people, other things, other... So from this mitzvah, source number 4, the Talmud learns, once you know the suffering of an animal is a Torah concern. The Torah goes back and forth on is this concept. In Hebrew it's called Tsar Ba'alei Chaim. Tsar Ba'alei Chaim means the suffering of animals. Okay, so the suffering of living things. So here the Talmud says, here we see that there is a concept, a mitzvah from the Torah, that we are not allowed to cause animals undue pain and suffering, especially in a physical sense. So the Talmud debates, is this a Torah law or is it a rabbinic law? So it seems it's a Torah law. Now, there is no mitzvah, per se, called Tsar Ba'alei Chaim. It's interesting, it's a Torah concept. Right? It's a concept of the Torah that's applied in different circumstances that we learn out mostly from this particular case of helping the animal from its burden. So there's some interesting examples we see that mention that this is a Torah law. Any questions on this before we go on? So source number five is from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, or a Chaim 305:19. I just want to get out the Hebrew here as well. So here's the case. This is a case on Shabbos. So behemah shenafal li'amat hamayim. So if an animal falls into a stream of water, and the water is deep, and the animal cannot be fed there because of this, right? You can't get to the animal. You can't feed the animal. One should bring the pillows and cushions and place them beneath the animal to enable it to climb out because of the obligation to prevent animal suffering, even though by doing so, you'll render these articles unsuitable for their designated use on Shabbos. And so, a few different things here. Number one, so you can feed the animal in its current state. Maybe it's suffering, it's in pain, maybe not, or just stuck. So you're allowed to bring these pillows, or I guess because they can walk on it, or it raises up the level so it gets the water too deep for it to get out, so it can help it climb on these things. So what's the problem? Why wouldn't you be able to do that? So there's this concept that if something is useful on Shabbos, you're not supposed to destroy, make it not useful. So once you take a pillow and put it into a stream, and it gets wet, you never use that pillow again. Right? That pillow is now useless. So it's considered like...
And then you wouldn't be able to take the pillow out of the water either, right? Because you can't...
That's muksa. And then, right, at that point it becomes muksa, because it's not usable, and you shouldn't make something muksa on Shabbos. So it's rabbinic prohibitions.
But isn't there like something with wringing water out and stuff?
Oh yeah, that's a whole other issue. Yeah, right. That's true. You might be wringing water out. Right. That's not the issue that's mentioned here, but that's true. If you would take it out, that would become a problem. So, even though this is a rabbinic prohibition, we're allowed to do it. Why are we allowed to do it in this case? So, here the Mishnah Berurah says,
Okay,
Afil hachi mutter da'atei tsar balechayim duderaita, because the concern of animal suffering overrides the rabbinic law on Shabbos. Okay, now we'll only override a rabbinic law if there's a Torah law that's there as well, right? When you have the two that go up against each other, a Torah law will always override a rabbinic law. So here we have this concept that we'll take it that since this is a rabbinic concern and there's a Torah concern of the suffering of the animal, so the suffering of the animal will take precedence. So because Mimadi is here, a Torah mitzvah prikata masa me'al behema v'dachi iser bitol kli mechana shirak midirabanam. And then also he adds here that ideally you shouldn't pick it up with your hands if you can avoid it, but there are those who say that you can lift it up with your hands, and certainly you can ask a non-Jew to do it even explicitly. Usually you'd have to couch it in some sort of
how you get a non-Jew in Israel?
That's plenty. There's always plenty. Mm. Yeah, but this isn't Israel. I mean, he's right in Poland, so.
Oh.
In the 20th century, so he had no problem with
20th
that.
Century.
He might not want to talk to the non-Jews around him, but they might want to kill him, but
yeah.
You know, they were there. He was well aware of their existence. Okay. So, here's just one example. There's other examples. Milking cows on Shabbos, right? So you're allowed to milk a cow, or certainly hire non-Jews to milk cows on Shabbos, because that would be considered painful if they weren't milked, you know, every day. So a few other examples that are given, but the general theme here is we see that there's a Torah concern to avoid the pain and suffering of animals. Okay, now are there exceptions to this rule? So let's say there's a few exceptions to this rule as well. Source number 6 comes from the Talmud. And here's the situation. So the Talmud is discussing a case when a king dies, the Jewish king dies. So you're allowed to destroy certain things, even though there's a prohibition of Baal Tashos. You're not supposed to waste things that are usable, right? So you shouldn't cut down fruit trees for no reason. Shouldn't waste food, right? That's Baal Tashos. You're wasting food. Right? Jews are obsessed with wasting food. It's still good. It's been there for a week. It's still good.
Ignore that mold on it.
Yeah. Just cut off that part of the lettuce.
No.
As the sole representative of women, no, throw it away.
It's right, so.
It's just penicillin. That's all.
No.
So even though there's a concept of Baal Tashos of wasting, you're not allowed to waste. When a king died, there's certain things the king used that they would burn, like his bed or his chair, things like that. They thought it was disrespectful for anyone else to use it.
How about the sun? The sun can use it, no?
They thought like certain things should be like that was the king's and no one else should. It's disrespectful. It's not proper for anyone else to use this.
Okay. You're not supposed to sit in your parents' chair, right? That's one of the.
That's true, unless they give you permission to. But you know, so that was seen. You know, they don't do this in the White House or anything. But that was seen as like a sign of respect that nobody else will use this bed. No one else will. You know, that was like a sign of respect. So they burn it, even though typically they wouldn't do such a thing. They wouldn't burn a perfectly good bed. So the Talmud says they apply this even to an animal. So the source number 6, they uproot animals for the honor of the king. What does it mean they uproot the animal?
They kill it.
They don't kill it. So Papa says it refers to the horse that the king rode. What? They wouldn't castrate it. They would like do something like cut a hamstring or something to prevent it from walking.
Why didn't they just move it to another town?
The idea was that no one else should ride the king's horse. No one else should ride the king's horse. If this was the king's horse, it's
the
king's horse.
Yeah, but that would be suffering for the horse.
Right, so Tosfot asks.
Cut something like that.
Right, so source number 7. So Tosfot is a collection of Ashkenazi, leading Ashkenazi rabbis from like the 1200s, 1100s to the 1300s. So Tosfot is not a person, it's a collection of people. So they, so there's different authors, but they ask this question. Why wouldn't this be considered unnecessary pain to an animal? Right? This is Tzar Bali Chaim. We just said that with this concept of Tzar Bali Chaim, the Talmud seems to conclude that it's a Torah prohibition. So how can they do this to this animal? So here it gives one exception. The honor of the king is different, since it is the honor of the Jewish people, and the honor of the masses overrides the prohibition of causing pain to an animal. So here, this is considered an extreme case. Certain things that apply to everybody else don't apply to the king, not only because of the power of the king, but because the king represents the Jewish people in its totality. So therefore, when you honor the king, you're honoring the Jewish people. And something that honors the entirety of the Jewish people, like this, then will override this law. The law doesn't apply. Okay? So it's an extreme situation, but that's Tosfot's answer. It's an interesting answer. But this applies to other things. There are other times when it seems that there are some types of animal cruelty that were done for a mitzvah, for a purpose. Right? So source number 8 refers here to when they were building, if you go here to, we're near there already, 25.5, page 444. Okay. So let's start from the beginning of the. It's short. Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, in 4:45, "Speak to the children of Israel, and let them take from me a portion. From every man whose heart motivates him, you shall take my portion." So this is where they're collecting all these different goods and valuable items to build the Mishkan, to build the tabernacle. "This is the portion that you shall take from them: gold, silver, and copper, and turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, linen, and goat hair, red dyed ram skins, tachash skins, acacia wood, oil for illumination, spices for the appointments, oil and the aromatic incense, shoham stones, and stones for the settings for the ephod and the breastplate." So all of these different things were taken for the purpose of building the temple. So number 5 in Pasuk Hey, it says, red dyed ram skins. What does that refer to? What are red dyed ram skins? So there's a few different interpretations that are brought down. One is that this refers to some sort of red ram. Red rams, and that's what these are. Other interpret that this refers to, they would make the ram's skin red. So how do you make a ram's skin red?
With blood.
What? With its blood. Well, how do you get the blood? So they would, well, no, you wouldn't die. So you would beat the ram. You'd hit the ram and make it red. And then you slaughter it. And then the blood would be trapped in the skin. If you beat it after the animal was shechted, then the body might not react the same way.
So, isn't that cruelty?
Isn't that cruelty? So again, it's not clear that's exactly what happened. That's one of the interpretations.
Oh.
Their interpretation that there were red rams. And that's what they used. They had this type of animal.
No, it said red dyed ram skin.
Yeah. So let me check real quick. Let me see if the commentaries discuss this.
I want to see who says what. Once we get inside.
I think the guided red after they worked on it.
So again, that's. So one opinion is that they would dye it red afterwards. No, again. So again, this is just one interpretation that I'm saying. I don't see it mentioned here. Okay. I mean, it goes so far that there's a question as to the concept of coloring or dyeing on Shabbos. And this is assumed as one of the examples. One of the examples was dyeing. So why is dyeing a prohibition? All the prohibitions of the Torah are learned out from things that they did to build the Mishkan. So where they have dyeing, so the dyeing was this. They say this could be it. These ram skins, either they're dyeing by dyeing it literally, or maybe that's this is what they did. Anyway, it's an example that's brought of a circumstance where they might have for the what they felt was the beautification of the Mishkan or the temple. They would allow a certain level of animal cruelty for that. So the very interesting case that's brought down. It's mentioned in the.
It's like top of the food chain. You can eat, you know, you kill anything just because you are top of the food chain.
Well, again, we're balancing this because obviously we've seen there's a lot of prohibitions that we have from doing whatever we want whenever we want to, if it's going to cause animal suffering. So we don't just do anything. But it seems that there's some wiggle room. Okay? So here, this is a responsa. From the Noda B'Yehuda. The Noda B'Yehuda lived in the 18th century, and he was the chief rabbi of Prague. And for his generation, was one of, if not the greatest, rabbis of his generation. He became the chief rabbi of Prague, which was even then a major Jewish city. I think he was like 25, very, very young age, and held the position for like 50 years or something. I mean, he was a very unique figure in Jewish history. And he was a very prolific writer and got questions from all over the world because he was, you know, so well known. So one of the questions he gets is from somebody who has a lot of land, right? He lives out in the country somewhere, he's got a lot of land. And he wants to hunt. That's his question, he wants to hunt. So he wants to know, am I allowed to hunt?
What year is this?
He lived in the 18th century. I'm sure someone could...
1700?
1700s, yeah. I'm sure someone go on their phones and find his exact... Rabbi... his last name was Landau. That was his
It was a very rich time. Very rich.
Maybe.
Jewish life in Prague.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
This I remember.
Come from
yeah.
America?
What?
The question didn't come from America?
No, this is before the American Jewish community was even... was anything. So Landau was still a very popular Jewish name. And there, he still has many, many descendants with the name Landau. So if you meet a Landau, it's a decent chance that they're a descendant of his. So if you're like Landau, Prague, something like that, you'll find it. His exact...
very interesting
his name is... Wait, hold on a second. Let me...
L-A-N-D-A-U?
Yeah, it's L-A-N-D...
It's very interesting city.
What's his first
you ever
name?
Been there?
I never... I'd love to go. What?
Very interesting.
Oh gosh, let me see.
L-A-N-D-A-U.
In Prague.
Yecheskel Landau, yeah.
Zico.
What's the last, how do you spell the other word? Prague?
P-R-A-G-U-E.
No, I know how to spell Prague, but what's the Haskell?
Yecheskel. You probably won't need that.
You probably won't need that, yeah.
Okay, I'll just put in Prague. Which is P-R-A-G-U-E, right? Yeah. There we go. Okay, yeah. Wikipedia. That's good.
His own page?
Yeah.
That's how you
There's
know that
There's a picture of him wearing a nice
Oh, wow.
Hat.
What year?
Born 1713, died 1793. So
that's 18th
life.
Century,
yeah.
So how old was he when he became chief rabbi, does it say?
Influential authority in Jewish law, his best known work is the Noda.
Yeah, that's what I feel. The Noda.
Okay, he was appointed a rabbinical judge in 1734. And... So
he'd be
he was
21.
Born, yeah, okay, so, and then in 1745 he became the rabbi of Yampol, Yampol. While in Yampol he attempted to mediate between Yaakov Emden,
yeah,
and Jonathan
Eibschitz.
Yeah, in a debate, the whatever controversy had, let's see, his role...
And the controversy was described as tactful. They mentioned that a couple of times, actually. And then in 1755, he was appointed rabbi of Prague.
So he was 30, so he's a little, so he's 38.
55?
He's 38.
He's 42, no?
He's born in
1713?
1713. Oh, so 42. Okay, so 21 he becomes an abatis, so he was old. 42. He's chief rabbi of Prague. Okay, a little later.
So he got this question.
So he got this question. This guy wants to hunt.
America.
What?
Could have came from America. The reason I say white from America is in Europe, a lot of the animals in the Decime, you didn't have wild game so much.
Yes, they had, yes, even today. They have forests. They had forests which was kept just for the wild animals.
So now a lot of Europeans would come here, like the 1800s, to shoot game in buffalo because there was nothing there.
No, they killed buffalo because of the skin.
Don't want the buffalo. So it doesn't say where it's from. Anyway, so, you know, first he's trying to understand who this guy is. Like, you know, he's doing hunt, right? That's for Hicks in Mississippi to be doing, right? Jews don't hunt. You know, he even says, like, that's what Asaph did. Why would we do that, you know? But he addresses the question. And the question is it tzar bali chayim to hunt, to kill for sport? Is killing for sport considered? So he says, look, killing is not suffering. It's not suffering. Suffering means causing the animal undue physical or emotional pain. But killing the animal quickly is not tzar bali chayim. So that's bal tashchis, that's wasting. So if you're going to use the animal for something, you're right, it's very common, they would kill animals for hide. And they wouldn't necessarily shech them to keep them kosher. They went to their hide. They'd take animals that weren't kosher and kill them for their hide. So that was okay, because that was considered a use, you know. To kill them for sport and just let them die there and to cut off the head and antlers and put them up on your wall, so that's not a purpose. So that would be, that wouldn't be tzar bali chayim. That would be bal tashchis.
You can do both, actually. You can kill them for the hide and then take the head and put it on the wall.
Yeah, once you take the hide, then in theory you can do whatever you want with the rest of the carcass. So then he adds, V'nam ein lanu l'arich b'zeh ki kvar herich mehari b'poskim v'ktavim simen kofhei shekol davar sheyesh bo tzorach li'adam leis b'mishim tzar bali chayim. So anytime there's a purpose for people, so then it's not tzar bali chayim. But instead, it's only if you keep them alive. If you kill them, it's not a problem. So, anytime you have a real purpose for human need, so then we do not apply this concept of suffering for animals. So, animal testing. Okay? Testing for animals, if there's a medical purpose, then it's allowed. Then it's allowed. Because there's a human purpose to it. And that's a time when we'll allow suffering for animals. Because we think there's a greater purpose for humanity. That's allowed. As long as, you know, you're minimizing the pain to what's necessary. And as long as you are keeping things, you know, you're not doing beyond what you need to do. But so that's allowed. But killing, he says, is not a problem of tzar bali chayim ever. So certainly you want to kill rodents, you want to kill things like that, that's allowed. Right? Rodents are not even really animals. In the halachic terminology that's called the sherets, they might not even apply under this rule altogether. Not saying you should go around and start torturing rats or anything.
Yeah, I mean, we have mice at our house, and it's like, I don't believe in glue traps because I feel like it unnecessarily makes the animals suffer.
And they don't really work that well.
Yeah,
the snap traps were much better.
And stuff like that.
The snap trap, well, they can get out of them. They say they have to get out of the glue
traps. You mean the glue traps? You mean they get stuck there?
And yeah. They get stuck in the glue, and it's terrible. I've seen them in
restaurants
and
stuff. It's gross.
Yeah.
Or you just leave them to starve to death.
How long you live them.
Yeah. Well, there's methods to kill them quicker, but it's not fun. You don't want to do it.
No, the glue is ugly.
Yeah, the glue, yeah. Anyway.
How about Al Akbar? The what? Akbar is a Hebrew, the mouth. Al Akbar, Al Akbar.
The mouth.
So, anyway.
So, it's Arabic.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so that's what he writes. So therefore, anytime there's a purpose to it, it's allowed. So what's considered a purpose? So here it gets us back to this case of feedlots. So feedlots, I mean, there's a lot of different types of feedlots. There are some that are more... that are more humane than others. Okay, obviously there's your grass-fed field, you know, meat. Then there's feedlots, which are, okay, not crazy, not terrible. And then you've got the feedlots that are just repulsive.
Most grass-fed beef is finished with corn, though.
Well, finished with corn, that's their diet. But I'm not talking about the diet as much as the conditions they're living in.
No, but then they do put them in, like, these feedlots.
For, like, for a week or something?
Or like a month, and then...
Why they do that?
To fatten them up, but right before... You know,
how about stuffing?
No, they don't force feed them. They just put them in these
goose areas. And ducks.
They're dead already.
Oh, the foie gras? No, are you talking about the foie gras?
Yeah.
I went to France and they run to the feeder.
No, I was born in Budapest and it happened to be my parents were selling poultry. I tell you, that goose duck is good.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
They force feed the duck or the goose to get a bigger liver.
A bigger liver, okay.
Yeah. And frog, yeah, it's the liver.
Okay, well, they do in America to get bigger breasts.
No, you can't feed, of course, with him. I don't know how they do it, but...
I mean, they literally, like, put it down their throat.
They take a tube and put it down the throat of the duck, right? And then they force feed it. But I went to a foie gras farm in France, and they don't have to do that for long. They're like little pigs.
That's interesting, because that case is brought up here, that you're not allowed to do that to larger animals, or animals that chew their cud. There's a way that they could force feed so they couldn't regurgitate or something. So you're not allowed to do that. Yeah. That's considered painful. Yeah.
Yeah, that's if they chew their cud, but ducks don't do that.
Right. So it's not considered to be... So what I saw, that poultry that doesn't apply to you, you're allowed to eat the poultry. Not that you should, but it's not. But, no, anyway, so... So look, in America today, especially, people like to eat meat a lot, and they want to be cheap. Right? It's basically our society today. And, you know, we no longer live in societies where you're getting their meat from your local farm, or your you know, every town has four shochtim, and how would you get your meat? They checked it.
Yeah.
My Zadie was a butcher, and, you know, he had local, the animals would come, and they checked them locally, and then he'd go out and pick up the meat, bring it up, cut it and prepare it, and that's how it worked.
Yeah.
Right, there wasn't, the big slaughterhouses in Iowa and Nebraska.
And you didn't
wherever.
Eat meat like every day or every week.
My parents are just because my dad owned a butcher shop. So my grandpa, so they ate meat every day, but that's only
my
because of that.
Was a butcher before.
That's why. Yeah. That's why I know all about that.
I know, but most people like 100 or 200 years ago didn't eat meat as much as we do today.
Now, for sure. Look, when the Talmud talks about the delicacy, you know, of eating meat on Yontif. Right, eating meat on Yontif wasn't just, because we like meat. It's because it was a big deal. It was a big deal. I mean, you're allowed to shecht your own animal because that's what they would do. Yeah. So, for sure, we live in a different society. We live in a society that demands cheap meat and lots of it. And keep it coming. So, you know, what people don't want to, either they know it and don't want to think about it, is it means, well, how are you getting all that cheap meat? Where does it come from? Right? How do they get it? So they get it by expediting how fast animals grow, by keeping a lot of animals in a small area, by fattening them up quickly, by giving them a lot of corn and hormones, different things. That's how they get it. I mean, that's how they do it.
And then they have to give them a lot of antibiotics because they're in these close proximities.
Right.
And if they get sick.
They get
all of them
right. They're sick, and they're not living in the best conditions, and there's feces everywhere and manure and all that stuff. So.
That's enough not to eat meat.
Yeah, I mean,
that's enough.
Just drive down the 5 and you'll see the feedlots. I mean, they're right off the 5. You can see it.
You can smell them.
You can smell them, yeah. It's not hard to find them.
Even at night, when you drive at night, you're like, we're by the cows.
But when you drive down the 5, you'll see that sometimes you see, like, the farm fed and you see the feedlots, and they're, like, close to each other, but they're... It's very... I mean, the feedlots have no grass on them. There's no grass. It's all dirt and manure. And they're eating, you know, from these feeding stations. They're eating
I don't think it's that way, because Ginny's uncle was had a piece of property at Lodi, and it was divided four ways.
Okay.
And the animal, it could supply, there was 250 cows on that milk cow, and they went to quarter. When they eat one part, then they go to another one, and they wait 6 months before they get back to the first one. So the grass can
Those are grass-fed cows.
Yeah.
Right. Grass-fed cows is a whole industry now. That's why, you know, if it's grass-fed, it'll say on your meat, grass-fed cow. It says that because that's not the norm, because that's almost a delicacy at this point.
But it was the norm, and then we did, like, corn-fed.
Yeah, in the 60s, I think around the 60s, you know, once you had the advent of the fast food industry, where burgers were ubiquitous, and everyone's got burgers, so, you know, the demand for this got higher, and whatever, there's the whole system here, but, so the world as we have it now, you know, you can get meat, you know, how are McDonald's hamburgers 99 cents? Right? How does that work?
Not hamburger.
What?
Is it
half sawdust? There's some meat in there, right?
sawdust means literally sawdust? Hard to tell. Not sure where that came from. So it could be that there was some in there at one point.
Okay. And so anyway, so look, technically speaking, it's hard to argue that, you know, if you're going to say that it's for human need, then it seems that we saw that there's kind of this dispensation. Anything for human need, you can override Tsar Baalei Chayim.
Human need or human enjoyment?
Well, so that's the question. So, well, is there a need, right? Is there a need today for this? Is there a need, the need for cheap meat, is that a need or is that a luxury, right? So, animal testing for health reasons, we understand. There are the cases we had here, or the case of the king, that's the unique case. So, and for food is a human need, obviously. And they are growing this. I mean, these animals are not raised as animals; they're raised as food, right? They're food. They're a product. They're not a living being, really. So, the question is, how much is it our responsibility to step in? And is it technically Tsar Baalei Chayim? And even if it's not technically Tsar Baalei Chayim, maybe it's in the realm of Tsar Baalei Chayim, right? Maybe it's still something that we should be aware of and cognizant of. Of course, like anything, being cognizant of it means that we have to be willing to either eat less meat or pay more for it. That's what it comes down to. So it's hard to demand, you know, less.
I think meat would be important. You don't have no meat in your diet. Is
Well, nobody's saying no meat. Nobody's saying stop killing animals. The question is, how much we'd be concerned about the living conditions of the animals that we are eating. That's the question, right? And if you're going to have better living conditions, I mean, it'll be more expensive, and there'll be less supply, or certainly more expensive. So that's the question. That's the open right now. That's the open-ended question. I think that a lot of the, you know, the kosher agencies, and, you know, a few years ago when the whole Rabashkin scandal came out, right? Remember that whole scandal?
Yeah.
Right. So. That was beyond just cruelty. That was, you know, illegal immigrants being paid minimum wage under, you know, their wages weren't high enough, the working conditions weren't good enough. Something about a meth lab, which I don't understand on premises. I don't understand the meth lab. So
well, that's how they kept the cows happy.
They kept the workers happy.
No, that's how they kept the workers going.
So I still don't get the meth lab part of it. So this became a big thing, is that a kashrut agency is responsible not just for was the animal shechted in a kosher way, but also was the company running in an ethical way. Right? So an organization came out, wanted to give like an ethical hechsher to like let people know that the company is an ethical company. So that applies to, so that's going well beyond the scope of animal cruelty. But this became part of this discussion as well. Is maybe we can have some sort of hechsher that says this animal meets the standards of You know, it's non-feedlot. So I know, like Trader Joe's, they have their the meat's called Teva, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's supposed to be. I know. I think it says grass-fed and.
It says glatt kosher.
Glatt kosher, but it says there's no hormones. Certainly, I remember all the things it says.
It could be glatt kosher. It could be. You could feed it hormones. You could feed it anything.
Yeah, so it says no hormones. I think it says grass-fed, no hormones, and it's kosher. So, certain companies, and this is becoming an industry now. You know, where certain companies.
The empire is supposedly free range.
Really?
Yeah.
They do a lot of chicken.
Oh. I know, but that means is that they are not in cages.
Right. Oh, I see. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you can't take like a football-sized room and put like 10,000 chickens in it.
Right.
Where they're all like stepping on each other and pooping on each other. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. That's true. Right. Right. The cages are the. And there's like these huts.
Those are the eggs. Chicken.
The eggs, well, yeah, but also those that were raised for food. I mean, they also they keep them, whatever, like Tyson and all these big companies. They just, you know, I mean, as much as Empire's doing, Tyson's doing 10,000 times more, you know. So
somebody has to check in.
What
I remember in Hungary, one of the kosher guy, you know, was cutting, butchering the stuff. He was checked all the time.
No, so the kosher agency is going to check when the animal is slaughtered, that it was done correctly, and that the animal was healthy when it was slaughtered. Yes. Those are things they care about, right? But they're not responsible for the living conditions of the animal. That's not what the kosher agency does. That's almost a separate issue. The question is, should that become part of what the kosher agency is concerned about? Or is that just another, that's a separate part, that's a U.S. government concern? If the U.S. government cares, then let them make standards and we'll follow them. But if the U.S. government doesn't care, then why should, you know, anyone else care?
Also, if you give too
that's
much
the question.
Responsibility on the kosher division, then they have to do more work, they have to charge more.
Right, for sure. For sure. If they're responsible,
they pay pretty good on the kosher meat.
I know, I'm saying. No, but you would have to pay more if you now made them responsible for overseeing and managing.
Which might be more than the kosher stuff.
Yeah, no, you're right. So anyway, so this is a question I think now that we're that people are starting to ask, and I think it's in some ways a new question because this we've never eaten like this before. We've never raised animals like this before. This is a whole new way of living that we have today. So I think we're all kind of catching up to it and figuring out you know, how far do we apply this? Like we said, technically, could you get around by saying, well, it's food and it's human need? Yes. But that doesn't, you know, just because it's for food doesn't mean you can be cruel to it. You can't beat an animal and just say, well, it's for food.
Where do you draw the line between cruelty and not cruelty?
It's a good question also. Right. What's cruel or what's just less humane or inconvenient, right? So if you have animals that are, you know, stepping on each other and pooping on each other, so
they don't mind that, you know what I mean? Like, that's the difference too, is like, what do we kind of like
impose on it?
Yeah, on the animal is like what something that we wouldn't be comfortable with.
Yeah, it's not a natural environment.
Right, they wouldn't choose to live that way.
Absolutely.
Right.
But as you said, they're raised for food. They're like a crop. It's like growing lettuce.
Right, but that's the thing, is that the Torah never wants us to look at animals that way. That's why we have certain laws that's why we have a concept of a ban on cruelty to animals.
Keeping animals in zoo is cruelty.
Yeah, look, I mean,
but it's safe.
I'm sorry?
It's safe.
No, but it's a good question. I mean, you know, the dolphins in SeaWorld die at a much quicker rate than dolphins in the wild do. You know, it's not their natural environment. Then, you know,
they go crazy
for sure. Well, they're used to swimming in the open sea, and now
some guys do well. I think lions do very well.
It's hard. Yeah,
buffaloes do well.
Buffaloes do well. They don't want to be out there.
A buffalo,
in the park.
Put the buffalo in its wild, you know, eventually they become prey. They become prey.